Andy Cumming, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back, second half at the races, about 80 minutes instead of 90, as we have a tendency to to go long on occasion. And I should mention Dick's second leg. He got through the second leg of that pick three, sixth generation, the winner of that eighth race at Happy Valley. So live to the three and the seven in the nightcap. In Hong Kong. So we'll keep an eye on that. And I imagine, if I'm thinking back properly, Jennifer Kelly, when we were wrapping up talking about Sir Barton, the Sir Barton book, I made, as I do with all authors, what are you working on next? And she had already latched on to Bel Air Stud and Gallant Fox and Omaha and the Woodward Story. And it did not take long for her to get back to the Keeneland Library and do her fabulous research and put together another fascinating and authoritative tome tracking the stories behind the Woodwards and Bel Air Stud and the Foxes of Bel Air, Gallant Fox Omaha, and the quest for the Triple Crown. She's become the going expert on the Triple Crown in this country. Jennifer Kelly's back with us. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be back.
Well, keep writing books. We'll get you back.
That's the plan.
Well, you know, the best part of that, honestly, even before we talk about the book, we should mention, you know, for those that, I mean, anybody following Jennifer on the social media channels sees it and understands it. But, you know, for a wider audience, I mean, not only did you wade into this arena, you know, from a desert when it comes to thoroughbred racing, that you know you don't have a touchstone right close at hand.
Mm-mm.
But you've also immersed yourself in the media sensibilities around the game, and that includes you know, participation in the turf writers and broadcasters, and you know, you've just been a wonderful addition, and you know, somebody that is banging the drum for the sport and its history. And so thank you for that.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor to be able to give back to the game in this way, because it's given me so much in a very short amount of time. But even since I was a kid and watching the races, you know, 30 years ago or more when I first got into the sport, I'm just glad to give back however I can.
Well, let's dive into the book, and it's out widely now and available in stores and available from University Press of Kentucky, who we just think the world of. They do a tremendous service for you know, so many signature industries in Kentucky. They have you know, enabled countless authors to pursue their interests and their projects, and you know, put out you know, Lenny Shulman being published now by the University Press, and of course they have to survive an incursion by an insane former governor,
yes.
Jamie Nicholson. They've done so many great titles. Remind everybody how you settled, and I suppose, you know, part of it is the Triple Crown interest that came out of the Sir Barton story, and you unearthed so many things about the Triple Crown and its origins, you know, that I'm sure it led you into this story.
Well, honestly, what happened was when I was working on Sir Barton, part of, you know, proposing a project like that is you have to look at other titles that are available in that genre to show where you position the one you're proposing. And so as I was working on Sir Barton, I noticed that there were several Triple Crown winners that did not have books already. And so as I finished the first book, I started looking at what I was going to do next, and it seemed like a natural progression to go from Sir Barton to Gallant Fox in Omaha and kind of chronicle that time period where you're going from the very first one that's really not a thing quite yet into this era where racing is becoming more like what we're familiar with now. And you've got the Triple Crown and other, you know, developments going on in this era. So I really wanted to capture that moment.
Well, and of course, from that perspective, part of Gallant Fox's, I mean, career-wise, he stands, you know, he stands alone anyway, and established some new, you know, some new, you know, levels, including an earnings record at the time, but. 1930 and Charlie Hatton, essentially, and the coining of the term Triple Crown, and, you know, associating the three spring classics, and then in retrospect realizing, well, you know, that Sir Barton did that a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a fun deep dive that I did, starting with a Sir Barton book and then continuing through Gallant Fox, which is an article I'm putting out, or I'm not putting out. It's going to be in the Blood Horse, and the May issue is a discussion of that transitional decade and how the term Triple Crown became associated with those three races. And so, you know, with Hatton and other turf riders in that era, they'd start using the term more and more to refer to those specific three races, but it really took until you get to about Omaha's time where they started using it regularly and in that context. And then by the time you get to War Admiral, it's pretty much settled in as this is what the Triple Crown is, and this is what we're going to refer to it as. And then, and of course, in the late 40s, the Thoroughbred Racing Associations then start awarding the trophy, and, you know, it's solemnized into what we know today.
Before we talk about the horses, let's also establish the Woodwards and William Sr. and you know, his banking empire, and how you know, how Bel Air Stud essentially comes to be.
William Woodward had always shown interest in racing since he was a young man. He would relate anecdotes about going to Jerome Park with his father and seeing, I think it was the 1889 Belmont Stakes at Jerome Park, and then having this determination as a young man that I'm going to win, you know, the Epsom Derby one day. And that's morphed over time into not just winning the English Classics, but also winning the American Classics. And so when he starts Bel Air, he actually starts breeding at Bel Air before he owns Bel Air, because his uncle was still alive at the time. And then once his uncle passes away and William Woodward inherits the estate, he starts breeding more seriously, but he doesn't actually race his own horses. He leases them to his friend P.A. Clark, or Philip Allen Clark, at first. And then about 1923, I don't know what the catalyst was for this. I haven't been able to find a particular incident that made him want to go start racing his own horses, but he registers his colors, and in 1923 hires Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons at the end of the year after having a nondescript first season, and just starts racing and breeding his own horses until his death in 1953.
The passing on, and in fact it's already come up this morning with both Dick and with Sid, the passing on, of course, of the colors of the Bel Air brand, the Bel Air stable, we'll get to. But when it comes to Gallant Fox and you know, the way, you know, basically they burst on the scene, it's pretty splashy.
Yeah, the Fox was quite the horse. He was really the first superstar after Manowar, and there were a lot of comparisons between Gallup Parks and Manowar in newspapers, and of course there are people whose hackles got raised at those sorts of comparisons, but the Fox essentially was that first superstar horse of the 30s, and you know, kind of crowned the decade, and then of course the decade that followed is this sort of era of the super horse, and you have all these, you know, fabulous winners that, and especially during this time, because the Depression starts in around 1930, and of course by 1936-37 you've got Seabiscuit, but this is that era of, you know, trying to find a diversion because we're in the midst of this economic emergency and we need somewhere to direct our energies so that we're not feeling so despondent, hopeless. And you know, horse racing was that place where people put their energy, and it wasn't the only sport, baseball too during this era, but there was a lot of discussion about horses, and you know, Gallup Fox, and then Omaha, and then Seabiscuit, and on. So it was fun to start with Gallup Fox. He was quite the personality.
Well, and I tell the story that I came across in WHP Robertson's the History of Thoroughbred Racing in America, which is one of my favorites, of Gallup Fox standing at a gate because a biplane was flying over, and he watched it fly over the racetrack and had to be, I mean, literally, like, goaded into, you know, you gotta, hey, let's go, you gotta catch up.
It's a shame because that story didn't come up anywhere else. Like, it's only in Robertson's book. So if you when you read Fox's, you'll notice that I didn't include that anecdote because I couldn't find substantiation for it somewhere else. And so I really felt bad, like, omitting it, because you and I know others have brought that up. And I'm like, oh, I really wanted to include it. But, you know, none of the material I found from William Woodward himself or from St. Jim Fitzsimmons actually mentioned that. And so it's like, I'm not surprised if it actually happened. I just didn't want to put it in the book without having a second source, because I wanted to make sure that I had all the details right. So, you know, I went through William Woodward's memoir, and he mentions the horse looking around the country, which is what he called it, you know, just being distracted. And then I went through Jamie Breslin's memoir with Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, and it wasn't mentioned there either. And I found another article where Fitzsimmons says that Gallup Fox is more fascinated by the other horses than he was by his actual job. And that was why he was so tenuous in those first couple of starts. I hate that I didn't include that anecdote, because I know how much people love it.
Well, Robertson also described him as curious as a cat. That he was just from early on, that he was bright and obviously, you know, one of those horses that had a little bit more of an intellectual capacity than is typical, and that makes him instantly affectionate.
He was one of those that he never was aggressive with other horses or people. Like, you could find him after a race in a stall standing there dozing while the grooms are, you know, taking the tack off of him and rubbing him down. And he's just completely blissful and not worried about the people around him. There was one anecdote I read where he heard the sounds of a baseball game at Saratoga one day. And so he spent the whole day craning his neck trying to find out where these sounds were coming from. But then the next day he was completely unfazed by it. Or, you know, he would spot an umbrella on the ground and would nose around it to try to figure out what it was. But so once he was done figuring it out, he just moved on. And he was just that kind of horse where he was curious, and once he satisfied his curiosity, he was good. And he would just move on to the next thing.
Well, he only was off the board once in his career. It came early on in the Tremont. But other than that, and he was, you know, he was a good, if not, you know, if not obvious, you know, star in the making. He established himself as a 2-year-old, but really the 3-year-old season, that's when things really started to click.
Yeah, we wring our hands about how horses start their Triple Crown season, especially now with the point system. You kind of have to follow a certain path. But Gallant Fox raced, you know, multiple times at two, and they put him away in like mid to late September. And he didn't race again until the Wynn Memorial, which was April 26th. And that was his only start before he actually started the Triple Crown series. But this was back in the era when the Preakness was first, and so he won the Wynn Memorial on April 26th, then he won the Preakness on May 9th, and then 8 days later won the Kentucky Derby, and then didn't race in between before he won the Belmont. They wanted to start him in a race in between the Derby and the Belmont, but they opted not to because they wanted to make sure he was fit. So he was it was a different era for sure. And I guess they just trained him up to it. Omaha was much the same way. He raced, I think, nine times at two, and then but only won once, which didn't make people stand up and notice him as much. But I noticed that Damon Runyon called Omaha his Derby pick in August of 1934, which was, you know, 9 months before the actual Kentucky Derby in 1935. So they both stood out from the very beginning.
There's obviously, you know, countless anecdotes and the pieces of, you know, this story as the, you know, the career unfolds, and we'll certainly get to the Travers as part of this discussion. But one thing that was obvious, at least you know, to a notable participant in this, a handy guy on a horse, Earl Sandy, put off his retirement essentially to ride him.
Yeah, Sandy had gone through quite a decade in the 20s after he was unceremoniously taken off Sir Barton in the match race in 1920. He quit working for Commander Ross, went to work for Rancocas Stables, suffered a couple of serious spills in the 20s, and essentially had retired by about 1927-28. But he started training and owning his own horses, but found out that it was very expensive to do that. So he essentially turned back to riding and was very selective about when he was going to ride. And that was when William Woodward said, we should get Earl Sandy to ride Gallant Fox, because they needed the right person on the horse to get him to focus. Because Gallant Fox was a type that once he passed horses and he was in the lead, he would just kind of stop and wait for people to catch up to him or for other horses to catch up to him, because he didn't like running alone. So he's someone who could, you know, handle that personality. And they brought in Earl Sandy, and he was just the right guy at the right time. He's like, you know, Mike Smith or Frankie Dettori. He's the guy you bring in when you have a very specific job that you want done, and you need the right rider with the right amount of experience to handle a horse with a very specific personality. And so that's why they brought Sandy in for Gallant Fox. I don't think he would have been the same level of success with anybody else, really.
Well, the wins that start, you know, as a three-year-old, and they march through the Triple Crown. He actually, interestingly, there's a horse that figures as a rival and as a frequent mention as you tell the story. Which one, who was terrific at two, probably a little better at two than Gallant Fox, and then who ends up, you know, ends up being a protagonist in the greatest upset in sports history up to the time. And a moment in racing history that continues to be immortalized every summer up here at Saratoga, and that's Jim Dandy and the 1930 Travers.
It was such a great, you have to read the book and really read that section because that was a fun one to write. And I took my time writing that one because I wanted to make sure that I had gotten all the details down as much as possible because it was a pivotal race. It's historic. We have the Jim Dandy Stakes because of it. And I wanted to make sure I got as many details as I could in the book, considering that I had to balance writing about two horses and 100,000 words. Basically, what had happened was H.P. Whitney said, we're going to beat Gallant Fox in the Travers. That was his, he was bound and determined. We're going to beat him. We were better than him the last year. You know, he beat us in the Belmont. We're going to come back. We're going to beat him in the Travers.
He was favored. So he was favored in the Belmont.
Which one is
who we're talking about?
Right. And which one had been, you know, Whitney had had two stars in 1929, Boojum and Which One. And Boojum didn't really race at three, but Which One did and had a very slow start because he had problems with knee injuries. And so Which One was actually favored over Gallant Fox in the Belmont. Of course, Gallant Fox, you know, beat him easily. And then he had a then Which One had a quarter crack and had to lay off for a few weeks. And then he comes back at Saratoga and starts this win streak. And then we come to the Travers, and there's only four horses. There's, you know, Which One and Gallant Fox and Jim Dandy and one more. And it's like, if Gallant Fox had not been posted on the outside of Which One, we would not have had the race that we had. But because Gallant Fox was post position was to the outside of Which One, Sonny Workman progressively through the race pushes Gallant Fox wider and wider and wider into the track. And the problem with Saratoga, it wasn't a fast track. It had taken a lot of moisture, and the running lanes were different depending on the part of the track you were in. And they were actually running in the chewed up kind of part of the racetrack. And so as Workman is pushing Gallant Fox out further and further, especially around that last turn, is really working Which One to keep up with Gallant Fox and to stay ahead of him. And so as they're kind of battling down the stretch, here comes, you know, Jim Dandy on the rail, who's a natural mudder, so that he had no problem with the surface, and he just sort of sneaks by them. And by the time Earl Sandy figures out what's happened and Which One, who has Bo's attendant in the process of running the race, quits, and Earl Sandy looks over and sees Jim Dandy passing them on the rail, it's too late. He doesn't have enough horse or enough space to catch up. So it's just a classic, like, and there's some newsreels, but the best part is the photos in the William Woodward's memoir, which unfortunately, you know, there's only 50 copies of that exist, and I know where one is, and it's at the Keeneland Library. And the photos are just fantastic because they just show you progressively what happens over the course of the race. It's really fascinating to see.
Well, this, there's so much about it. That's part of, and you can read about it as well in the Travers book that Brian Bouye did as well. At the time, it was just a huge sensation. I mean, it's, you know, of the half century, let's say, it's probably one of the top five stories of, you know, sports stories of the first 50 years of the 20th century, for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, 100 to 1, and you know, it's also, of course, one of the, although I have seen conflicting reports too about the use of Jim Dandy as a moniker, that it didn't necessarily come from the horse.
I think it predated him.
Yeah, that you know, for years it was thought that if you described something as a Jim Dandy, that it was the horse, but in fact, it was being used, you know, previously. Well, the nice part for Gallant Fox anyway is that he finishes out the career with three straight wins, including wins over Elders at the end of the year, which is notable. You know, he wins. People don't know now, but the Lawrence Realization was an enormous race. which he wins at a mile and five-eighths, Jockey Club Gold Cup, 2 miles, and, you know, goes on to a useful stud career, but of course, the best part of his stud career is what he does getting Omaha.
Yeah, and that was his first crop, too,
yep.
And then, of course, later he gets Granville and Flares, but Omaha was from that very first crop, and you know, this is back in an era when they're only covering 40, 50 mares at a time,
yep.
And you know, Lee Liverd would send a chunk of his mares to Gallant Fox, and Omaha was just the standout from that first crop, and then the next crop he gets Granville, who goes on to win the Belmont, and you know, and other races. Flares, who goes over to England and races about the same time Omaha does in England, but and they're full brothers, and it's just, and the Fox, I think, was just suffered from just limited books of mares, and then depending on who, you know, William Woodward allowed people to send his mares to the Fox, he just didn't have quite the same opportunity that maybe Sir Galahad III had had.
Well, the story of Omaha, not only is there, you know, the footnote of a Triple Crown winner siring a Triple Crown winner,
mm-hmm.
And you know, we probably have more potential for that, you know, now than
yes.
you know, than we had in years with both American Pharoah and Justified, you know, producing big crops. But Omaha, if people aren't aware, and you tell it, in between the Preakness and the Belmont, he gets beat. So
yeah.
it wasn't a hat trick, as it were, because he got beat in the Withers.
Yeah, he got beat in the Withers, and well, the Brooklyn handicap was after the Belmont, but he got beat by Rosemont in the Withers.
It was a nice
finished
horse.
Second. Yeah, and it was just, you know, it was a shorter race. The Withers was only a mile. And Omaha was one of those horses. He's very tall, and he had a very long stride. He was bred to be a stayer. And I think when you get these short, that's why he was so ineffective at two, was the shorter races just didn't suit him, because he was one of those horses that needed space, needed distance to find its momentum. And so often he had to be taken to the outside because he just needed space to get in the stride. And that, you know, Withers was just not long enough for him at all. So he was just not effective. He's much more effective, you know, at the Belmont distance at a mile and a half.
Well, and Rosemont was no doorknob.
No, Rosemont was not.
Yeah.
So that was a fun chance to learn more about that horse as well. So he was definitely not anyone to shake a stick at.
Well, and Omaha in the pantheon of the Triple Crown for, you know, for people at least my age, and that, you know, when we grew up, you know, getting to know, you know, the Triple Crown winners. I mean, I don't want to say suffered by comparison, but he was thought of at least for a period as kind of a lesser Triple Crown winner, and mm-hmm. which is unfair. and frankly, the coda of to his career when he went to England is really significant, actually, that Omaha distinguished himself later on as well. I mean, not that he didn't, you know, win races after the Triple Crown, including
I
can't remember if he won the Arlington Classic.
Well, and he was limited by injury. He had worked out. He had a really nice workout right before the Arlington Classic, and apparently the Arlington surface was cuppy that day, so he had strained his shoulder and had run fine in the Arlington Classic. But by the time they got to Saratoga, Omaha was not. He was training off, and they didn't want to push him, so they kept deferring his next start, because they had laid out the same path that Gallant Fox had run in his 30-year-old year. They had these milestones they were trying to get to. And every time he would get close to starting, that nagging injury would sort of flare up, and then they were reluctant to push him. So he just kept backing off, and finally figured out that it was probably not going to happen that year, and they needed to just send him back to Bel Air and let him recuperate. And this was about the time when William Woodward says, well, maybe I should just send him to England instead. So if I know he'll withstand training and that he'll pass muster with his English trainer, Cecil Boyd Rochert, then I will send him to England and he can try the Ascot Gold Cup, because he didn't need Omaha at stud. He already had Gallant Fox. And he already had Sir Galahad III. So he, you know, Omaha suffers from the fact that he had a shortened three-year-old career. He had an inconsistent two-year-old year. And then I think most Americans forget that he goes to England, because, I mean, honestly, when I started writing it, I vaguely knew he had had a four-year-old year, but I had not realized the depth of what he did it for until I started doing the research. And I mean, holy heck, that Ascot Gold Cup, he finishes second by nose to Quashed, and it was considered the greatest race of the 20th century in England. Americans don't know that.
No, and he had won a couple of races at Kempton preparing for mm-hmm. the Gold Cup, and then he's second as well in the Prince of Wales, mm-hmm. you know, later on to his last career start. But he you know, distinguished himself over, you know, over real distance, because the Gold Cup was 2.5 miles.
Right. Boyd Rochert said if he had had Omaha the whole time, had trained him from the very beginning, Omaha would have been a sensation in England, because he would have won all these staying races. So it was just, he was just amazing at, you know, over in England to do something that no one has done. I mean, other than Secretariat ran in Canada, and then Sir Martin ran in Canada as well. They had like the one start in Canada. No one has ever sent their Triple Crown winner overseas to try racing on the grass in a completely different direction at these long distances. It's just amazing that Omaha did that. And that's one of the things that motivated me about writing the book, was to really emphasize and overcome this assumption that Omaha was a subpar Triple Crown winner, and to demonstrate to people, you know, he did this extraordinary thing of, you know, adapting to a whole new surface and a whole new direction and a whole new way of racing in a very short amount of time.
Well, and you know, part of the other reputation, you know, the dent in the reputation that he suffered was that he washed out a little bit at stud. It didn't come for him. And there's even a bit of a, I guess we have to discuss this. There's the ignominious end. I mean, he ends up in Nebraska, and was very popular, is buried at Exarban, and the location of the grave is lost to time and to history, and no one knows precisely where he was laid. It's one of the game's great mysteries and oddities, frankly.
I've spoken to people who are familiar with Nebraska and Nebraska racing, and the ongoing theory that we have presently, because Omaha did, he stood stud at Claiborne for a few years, didn't really get the same mares, the same opportunities that Gallant Fox had, suffered from just basically William Woodward having this, you know, embarrassment of riches in terms of stallions, goes to the Jockey Club Breeding Bureau in upstate New York, sires, you know, sport horses and a few thoroughbreds, and then the Nebraska people bring him in because they want Grove Porter and others wanted a, you know, named stallion to kind of rejuvenate their breeding out there, because they had Exarban and later Horseman's Park and Fawner. And they really needed a star to kind of help publicize, you know, the breeding scene out there. So they bring Omaha in, and he lives at Groves Porter's farm in Nebraska City. And I was very fortunate to be able to connect with Porter's grandson, Budge, and they supplied some photos, which was lovely. And, you know, Omaha, they fall in love with the horse. He becomes like part of the family. And then when he does pass away, they bury him at Ex-Harbin, but Ex-Harbin closed. And when they went to move Omaha, they couldn't find him. And the going theory is that he washed away, that the water table changed where he was buried, and that the, you know, because it's organic material, he just basically washed away with the changing, you know, underground, whatever goes on underneath. So that's the best that we can come up with without, you know, more substantial proof. So he's just gone.
Well, gone, but not forgotten.
Gone, but not forgotten.
The Beyond the Triple Crowns, and that's the focus of the Foxes of Bel Air. Jennifer Kelly with us for a few more minutes. Gallant Fox, Omaha, and the quest for the Triple Crown. What surprises? I always ask this. What surprises were there in the research? Also, give out some credits and thank yous to everybody that contributed to putting the book together.
Surprises? I don't know that there were the same surprises that I found with Sir Barton. Certainly with Sir Barton, the cough that predicated him staying in New York and trying to Belmont was the surprise that I had found. With Gallant Fox in Omaha, that was pretty straightforward. I think there really wasn't a lot of things that, you know, hadn't really been said. I just enjoyed delving deeper, especially into Omaha, Gallant Fox and Omaha in their younger years, but also that developing relationship between William Woodward and Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons and how that came about. But also it was nice to piece together exactly the timeline of William Woodward starting racing, because I kept seeing that, oh, he raced under the nom de course P.A. Clark, and I had to do a lot of digging to find that P.A. Clark was an actual person. He was a friend of Woodward's, and they, you know, he leased horses from Woodward because Woodward thought owning racehorses and racing them in his name was unseemly until apparently 1923. So that was the one that was kind of fun to do, going through the Travers and piecing together how that worked in 1930, and then going through and doing the Ascot Gold Cup and trying to wrestle that into a narrative that was, you know, usable but within my time limits, because, you know, our books, the books in the series, the Horses in History series, generally run around 100,000 words. So to write about two different horses, both of whom started, you know, around 20 to 25 times in 100,000 words, and cover William Woodward and Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons was a balancing act. And so I have to credit, in this case, the ladies at the Keelan Library for helping me dig up stuff. Rhoda Ferraro, Kelly Kaufman, Vicki Ryder. Photos, material, especially during COVID. And I have to give them big props, because during COVID, Keelan was closed. And so I, Milt Toby, and a few other writers, we dealt with a lot of, like, how are we going to access material when everything is closed? And the librarians at the Keelan Library were essential to getting this done. Could not have done it without them. And so I give them huge props. Jamie Nicholson and my two beta readers, Sheila and Kelly, I give them huge props for helping me wrestle this into a, you know, readable format that wasn't overwhelming. You know, and just everybody at Kentucky Press for not just supporting me as they have, because they have supported me since 2017 when I signed my contract for Sir Barton, all the way through now. They support me, Milt Toby, Avalyn Hunter, Jamie, Lenny, and all the writers that have been able to, Peter Lee, have been able to publish titles with them. I mean, the press is committed to supporting horse racing and the sport by publishing books like this and by keeping these stories in the consciousness. And, you know, I can't thank them enough for doing that. Milt has a book coming out in August. Avalyn has a book coming out in September on Black Gold, and both of those are going to be, I've read both of them already, and they're both wonderful reads that I cannot, you know, espouse kudos to Hiley enough. So I hope that covers all the people. I want to thank you too, Steve, because you like make our job easier by talking about our stuff. So thank you to you too.
Not at all. My pleasure. My pleasure.
You give us a forum to talk about it, and you support the press, and so we really appreciate that.
It's my pleasure. Tomorrow we'll talk to Catherine Mooney about her book. Jennifer Kelly having joined us. And I suppose a final question to include regarding the Foxes of Bel Air, how much bigger this would be, or if there would be a second accompanying edition if Damascus and Nashua had won the derbies, their derbies. Because it should be noted, I mean, everybody thinks about Calumet to some degree on this, but the Woodward family came within, you know, Damascus basically fretted himself out of a derby win by the noise and the commotion at Churchill. He completely washed out, and Shoemaker said that he had half of the horse he usually did, and he still finished third. And Nashua really did not have he didn't have the excuse that Native Dancer had, I mean, of chasing a hopeless long shot. But, you know, Nashua second. And they could have had four Triple Crown winners.
They could have, and that would have had to be a second book. Because that was one of the downfalls to a 100,000-word book, is that you cannot cover all the material that you really could cover. And honestly, I think it would be great if someone, maybe me, someone else wants to try it, cover a book about William Woodward and all the horses that he raced. Because, I mean, just Nashua and Damascus by themselves could be books.
Wow.
And then, you know, you talk about Woodward and then his son racing Nashua and then his daughter racing Damascus, and just the breadth and the depth of what Bel Air was able to accomplish. They were Calumet before Calumet was Calumet.
Right.
They were the progenitor of all that.
Well, and as I mentioned with Sid, you know, because of his, you know, the breeding side, you know, really an heir to the Laurelards and the Belmonts of the game. I mean, the Dwyer and Jerome, and you know, all the various, you know, late 19th century and the first quarter of the 20th century. The game is so rich with these stories, and you know, it's also part of American history. What's your next project?
I have I have a long list of projects that I hope that I will eventually do, and I hope I live long enough to do them all, because it's quite a list. I'm working on the next project. I've started thinking about it. I have a book proposal done. I just don't want to share what it is yet until I know that it's, you know, going to be like all the and it is a Triple Crown related, but it's not going to be another Triple Crown biography, but it's going to be in the vein of studying the Triple Crown as a concept and a phenomenon in within racing, because I feel like, you know, one of the benefits of studying history is that we learn why we do what we do now so that we can plan for the future. So I really want to continue looking at racing's history and what we can learn from it for our present as we, you know, think about what we want it to look like in the future.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, they're always fascinating, always terrific. Jennifer Kelly back with her second Triple Crown centric and now a third Triple Crown centric project is in the offing. You can follow Jennifer. She's basically opening a Twitter account for each book. There's Jennifer Kelly under the Sir Barton, and then there's Jennifer Kelly under Foxes of Bel Air.
I'm going to have to stop doing that because it's getting hard to keep up with all of it.
Exactly.
I think I just have to go to the one.
Good idea. Jennifer, the book, of course, available under, I don't want to give specific onlines, but Goodreads, I will give a specific. You don't have to get it at the big monolith of bookstores. You can get it from the smaller private access like Goodreads and the like. And then, of course, directly from the University of Kentucky Press, and look at the rest of their titles while you're there. Buy Lenny's books and more. Jen, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure.
Congratulations. Jennifer Kelly,
thank
everybody.
You.
I love it. She's so much fun, and she just absolutely has immersed herself in the culture and the history of the game, as so many do. It's infectious. Speaking of infectious, I got a guest you're going to love, and it should be a lot of fun. We're going to talk to Mark Lieb, and this is going to fall into... It's going to fall into the category we've been touching on with the CAW, because Ron Anderson and I had a conversation on Saturday about about some of the difficulties that the game is facing, and we're hearing more and more anecdotes from players that are just frustrated with the way things are, and it's more about the actual. The actual horseplay and the satisfaction of the play than anything else. And Ron thought that Mark Lieb could add some perspective to this discussion. He loves the game. He's an avid player. Mark, I know you've owned. I've seen your name on ownership lines over the years. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Steve?
I'm great. And I don't want this to be the game is listing conversation, but somebody like you that has put a lot into it and who really cares about it, hearing from someone like you is, I think, very valuable.
No, absolutely. No, I appreciate it. I appreciate the time. And Ron Anderson and I are very dear friends. And it just seems like every time something like this happens, I always call him and say, "Did you just see what just happened?" And, you know, I happen to know a lot of people at many racetracks around the country. I've spoke to guys like Nate Newby at Santa Anita. I speak to Tony Olivato at NYRA. And it just seems like certain tracks just have no interest in dealing or helping the player right now. And they want to take this offshore money where they get, monetized at the end of their plays. And basically, Santa Anita has finally figured out a way how to stop this. It's just that track itself. NYRA has figured out a way how to stop this. They've slowed it down to where, like, 3 to 4 minutes before post, they're not giving out the, extra money to these players. And they're letting them play, though, but they're not giving them the extra money. Keeneland is, like, I cannot believe what's going on at Keeneland this meet. There are horses that are going. I bet a horse the other day on Saturday that was 31-1 going into the gate and closed at 9-1. And to me, there's just got to be an end to this. It doesn't make sense. Del Mar definitely doesn't care. They want the money in the pool. That's all it comes down to. NYRA has made a decision that, they're cutting guys off 2 to 3 minutes before post. And my hat goes off to the tracks that really care about the gambler.
With that as a starting point, I mean, talk about first your history in the game because I know you've had horses and you play seriously and regularly and what has been the evolution when it comes to the way you're viewing things?
Well, I mean, I've been playing probably horses for well over 30 years. And, based on just watching the way that the game has gone, obviously the player just hasn't meant anything to any of the tracks anymore. They're taking a lot of money, obviously, from ports and, Vegas and different other sites around the country. I mean, listen, horse racing today is probably not what it was 30 years ago because we used to always go to the track because that was the only way we were able to make bets and watch races. Today, obviously, I could sit in my office and I could watch 20 tracks at a time, bet online. I don't need to go to the track anymore. So obviously the tracks are losing the fans. No one's really going anymore except for the summer meets at Del Mar and Saratoga. And I mean, you could take a look at some of the other tracks around America. They're I don't even want to call them half empty. I mean, they're a quarter empty. And I, you know, the way I see it today is just the player is comfortable from home and they want to get some kind of reward. And having back some type of rebate is what they've, you know, what the player is interested in today. So the only thing about that is how is that fair to the player? I was with a couple of friends on Sunday, I believe, or Saturday it was, and another horse at, I mean, Keeneland, if someone took a snapshot of the odds going into the gate at Keeneland, they would be shocked to see these horses get pounded. I mean, cut in half, cut in a third. And when it comes down to it, I'm okay with that. If you have some kind of vertical wager, obviously you're already in the bet. But you're making some kind of bet and you think that you're getting certain odds and you're not. To me, it makes no sense at all. I don't think Keeneland cares at all. At all. And I'm sure Churchill Downs, I have no idea what they're going to be up to, but I think it's just getting worse and worse.
Yeah, certainly the perception and some of these, you know, some of these visuals, and especially when there's every, you know, when everybody's focused on a meet like Keeneland, and you know, the first one opening weekend that was, you know, that was immediately a cause celeb was Hear My Song in the Commonwealth. And as it happens, I was kind of tracking that a little bit, and Nick Tamaro, who makes the morning line at Keeneland, he and I were kind of going back and forth after the reaction, because Hear My Song, you know, dropped down to 12-1 from about twice that. But when you looked at the Will Pays for the double, he ended up as the seventh choice. He was co-seventh choice on the morning line. He ended up co-seventh choice, actually, in play, and he was the eighth longest payoff in the doubles. So, I mean, there were signs. I mean, there's on a regular basis, there's these signs, and I mean, a lot of this, I mean, I continue to maintain that some of this is perception, that if we, you know, that if we helped everybody understand what those projected final odds are going to be, because almost, gosh, Mark, I mean, on a regular basis, they're falling right in line with the doubles and with the pick three Will Pays is where these horses end up. And it's just the way the money is flowing in, and because of the way that, you know, they're sending in their money, it the perception early is wrong. I mean, the odds are disproportionately high, and we've got to figure out a way to help players anticipate where the price is going to actually be and what the actual real price is probably going to end up.
There's no question. I mean, listen, as you said, the verticals are already set in place. Guys already have the money in the pool. I don't believe that these rebate guys are betting into verticals, because unless they see something right away that you know, that strikes their fancy, they're going to need to go all or all in the next race, because they're, I mean, no, those guys are not handicapping horses. They're handicapping money. And that's what it comes down to. If they see a number that doesn't make sense, they're going to pound it. It doesn't have anything to do with the horse or the race or the handicap or the weight or Lasix or anything. It means nothing to them. They don't even know what they're betting on. They're betting on money. It's all about money. And in those systems that they have set up, which obviously are very good, because I think they do very well with their rebates, and sometimes they do cash tickets and get very lucky. There was a horse in the 11th race on Saturday, which they had a big contest at Keeneland. There was a horse called You're So Cilia. He was the rail. That horse was 28-1 going into the gate. He closed at 11-1. Ran second, didn't win, obviously. Now, I'm not sure that those guys bet into the place pool. I think they really only bet into the win pool, but I may be wrong about that, so I'm not really 100% sure. But if they make it a situation where they say, listen, at 3 minutes, which is, I think, what Naira is doing now,
yeah.
thanks to Tony Olivato, who cares about the players, they've got a great product, the best product probably in the country. They have a time where they cut off the rebate houses. I believe it's 3 minutes. Don't hold me to that, but I believe that's what it is. Mm-hmm. They're allowing them to bet into the pool after 3 minutes, but there's no rebate given. So the bottom line is those guys are not betting into the pool after 3 minutes because they don't get the rebate. The rebate is what they're playing for. It's not to get the win on a horse because they have no idea if the horse is going to win, lose, or draw. No one knows that. And I'll keep watching these Keeneland races, and I'll keep watching these bet downs. And, you know, Keeneland's lying to you or to anybody else. If you ask them, they're going to say, hey, it is what it is. You get what you get. Del Mar, same situation. Santa Anita, Nate Newby has figured out a way, the same way as Naira has at Santa Anita, to figure it out. I have no idea. I don't watch a lot of Gulfstream, so I don't know what goes on at Gulfstream. But obviously that's a Stronach track. So if Santa Anita's doing it, you never know what they're doing over there. It doesn't happen as much at Oaklawn that I've seen.
Yep.
I can tell you that it's happened for sure at Turfway quite a bit this season. I've been watching it there. So there are certain tracks. I mean, listen, there are certain small tracks around the country like Parks. They need those guys to put money in their pool. They're desperate for that money. Smaller tracks around the country need it. The bigger tracks, yeah, they would like it. It helps them. But I don't know how much they need it. So I think they're willing to turn a blind eye to it and say, listen, we're going to let it go or we're not going to let it go. And there has to be a way where whether or not they put the first horse in the gate and they slam the gate, maybe they just close the pool completely just to show people, hey, listen, we're on board. I mean, we could go back, was it 20 years ago, the Pick Six scandal?
Yeah.
I mean, you go back to that, and people always say, who's betting after the race started? Who's betting after the race started? I mean, we know that they're not betting after the race, but the bottom line is the money is being dumped in after the race starts. You get a race at a mile and a 16th. When they hit the clubhouse turn, halfway through the clubhouse turn, the money gets dumped. And then all of a sudden, boom, the odds are crushed.
Well, and I've addressed that, Mark. I mean, a lot of this can be influenced, ameliorated by a modernization of our technology. And I mean, this drum has been banged on for ages. The Tote Protocol Working Group that was supposed to bring, you know, the whole industry in, you know, current with the standards that of technology, you know, that are available. That last flush that comes when the bell rings, it by the time it gets into the system electronically, there still has to be a lag. And not only is there a lag, but the video presentation that puts the numbers on the screen is always two flushes behind. So,
yes.
And until there's a change in the running order, you will not see the odds reflected. And even then, if there is a change in the early running, it's probably one or two flushes behind. We've got to get in real time so that that perception it doesn't crop up whenever it does crop up. And I mean, people also, by the way, don't notice. They notice the ones that are when the prices are going down. They don't notice the ones whose price has gone up, because anytime there's a horse price came down, there's a horse whose price went up. It's reality. But
no, there's definitely times when horses' prices go up. I don't see it because obviously I'm not looking at it. But I don't see horses go from five to like.
No, 15.
You know, my buddy, I got a good friend who plays out of Cincinnati. They call him Keeneland Dan Cronin. And he absolutely goes wild when he sees this. He's got a lot of people that play with him, and they work together, you know, in Cincinnati and in Keeneland and in the Kentucky racing. And he's the one, he points it out to me all the time, shows me all these things. It's just absolutely, it's just insane. And you mean, listen, if you're watching a football game and all of a sudden they said, you know what, you laid three, but now you're going to lay seven because the line changed at the last minute because of the money. I mean, I don't know if it will ever happen, you know, in our lifetimes, but fixed odds would be amazing.
It's
you know,
close.
In the United States. I know that they're working on it.
It's close. It's getting closer, you know, every... just on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, it's they're working on it. I mean, let me lighten the positivity index, because you're not a guy that's known as a grouser and a you know, and a kick the cat type. You really enjoy the game and you're involved.
I do.
It's occurring to me. Are you involved with the Del Mar Group team?
I'm not involved with the Del Mar Group for this round, but I have a lot of great friends who are in the Del Mar Group that I'm very, very good friends with.
Yeah, it occurs to me because I know you had horses with Doug. You were involved,
yes.
Right? Super Blitz. You.
Yep. Super Blitz, Kohavi. I've owned a lot of. I basically gave Doug almost one of his first horses that he ever trained. Doug is an absolutely great friend and, you know, one of the best trainers on the backside you'll ever meet, one of the best guys you'll ever meet. And, yeah, so we've had a lot of success with Doug.
What makes you, you know, still love the game and want to see these things fixed and you know, talk about the things about the game that brings you back, you know, every week.
I mean, I'm excited to watch horse racing. There's something about it. I mean, obviously I love gambling. So, the gambling, you know, listen, if they didn't have gambling on horse racing, would I watch it? Yeah, I probably would watch it. Would I be so excited about it? No, probably not. But I love the people that I've met hundreds and hundreds of friends from the racetrack, and you know, we're always together. We have a group that we always go to Vegas during the Derby. We're always down at Del Mar almost every weekend. We go out to Saratoga and visit Tony and all the guys. I know a lot. You know, Ron Anderson's one of my best friends. So, you know, I know a lot of jockeys, know a lot of trainers. Barry Abrams was an absolutely dear friend of mine.
The greatest.
God rest his soul. One of the greatest guys the racetrack has ever seen.
Yep.
And so I just like the camaraderie at the track. We could all go together. We all, you know, it's sharing information, being able to. I'm a huge sheets reader, Ragusan sheets reader. And, you know, we just all have a good, you know, good time together. Eric Johnson, very dear friend. So, you know, we just have a lot of guys, and Doug puts a lot of guys together, friends. Mark Verge, very good friend. And, you know, we just, the Del Mar Group, which you had mentioned, which is a group that was formed by Mick Cronin. He's done an amazing job with guys who, you know, have some money and just want to be able to own, you know, a lot of different horses. And I think that he's done that very well. They've had some winners so far. They almost had a horse that could have qualified for the Derby.
Henry Q.
And Henry Q. And he'll be coming back soon, hopefully in a good race. But, you know, they have a good time. And I think horse racing groups, per se, like the Del Mar group, like, you know, all the different groups around the racetrack, I think it's a good situation for everybody because everybody could kind of have a little piece in the game. And to own a horse, obviously, I always tell somebody, they say, you know, I want to own a horse. I said, just own a horse. Don't own two, don't own three, don't own four, because you're always going to need to have one horse that's going to need to pay the bills. And I learned that, you know, being in the game so early. But I think, you know, listen, as long as you keep getting checks, you're going to be fine. And you're going to end up making money. It's, you know, it's a great sport. It's fun. Most of the trainers at the track are good people. The summers are unbelievable at racetracks. Del Mar and Saratoga are unbelievable places. I just wish Del Mar would jump on and help out the gambler with the, you know, with the betting pool. But, you know, I think that that's something that they're not interested in discussing, and I don't think they want to help anybody. So that's their situation right now. But, you know, needless to say, I mean, horse racing is a great sport. I just think, and I've told this to Ron Anderson two or three times, name me any other sport in the world, and I'll call horse racing a sport, who doesn't have a commissioner who oversees the sport. I'm not talking about a general manager at a racetrack or, you know, CHRB, whoever it may be.
Right.
A real commissioner. And I think the sport needs a real commissioner. Somebody who, I mean, this, the Bob Baffert situation, for one. I mean, I'm not saying it's gone on long enough, but I mean, it's becoming a joke now. Have somebody there who could make rules, who could help guide the regulations that the tracks are trying to use, whether it be medications, whatever it may be.
Well, that's HISA. That's what HISA's aim is, and it, what the potential is in HISA. And you know, Lisa Lazarus will be as close to that role as we're going to have. I mean, the calls for commissioner have gone on. If you go through any historic writing about the game, they've been calling for one for 125 years. And
exactly.
Well, it's impossible. It's logically impossible historically, because there were all of these racing associations with rich, powerful people, and nobody was going to acquiesce their authority. And then when the states got involved, for people who wonder why we don't have a commissioner, this is why. And then once the states got their claws into the game, and it became a source of tremendous revenue for their coffers, they weren't interested in giving up authority and to a central body, governing body. So one of the game's great positives, we just talked about the Woodwards and Bel Air Stud. The history of the game is one of its really, you know, fabulous aspects. It's also been to the game's great detriment because of how creaky and aged a lot of its infrastructure is. And I'm not talking, you know, post war. I'm talking post war of 1812. I mean, that's what you're talking about here. It's one of the real thorns in the game side. And you know, you're not wrong on that front. And I mean, the HISA thing is a quandary, because we all would like to have you know, a lot of the things that might come with it. Those that are questioning its construct are doing so based on the way in which this thing was foisted upon us. So,
well, the racetrack has many, many, many different people at it. You've got actors, you've got comedians, you've got attorneys, you've got CEOs. There's a million different people who scurry at the racetrack. There's got to be somebody who could take the side of the player, who could take the side of the horseman, who could take the side of the trainer, who's somebody who would benefit the game. And until they find that person, you know, I mean, there's CHRB has had some great people that have helped run that, you know, like Marty Wygod, who have been the heads of these groups. And if they could find that person who could be able to act and judge fairly for all sides, not just take the side of the old guard at in Keeneland or in Kentucky or, you know, or this or that. But I think they got to find that person. They should find him faster than later, because every time they say they're going to do something, whether, you know, whatever they're planning to do, they drag their feet. And it, I mean, look at the Bob Baffert situation. If you were a brand new player to the horse racing game and you saw what was going on with Baffert, or you heard the story, you would say, something's wrong here. I'm not taking sides, whether he's right or he's wrong. Obviously, they caught him with something in his horse, and they gave him his punishment, but the thing keeps dragging along. And the tracks are doing a great job, by the way, of bringing in the young better. I mean, let's be honest, FanDuel and DraftKings has turned 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old players like overnight, betting $5, now they're betting $20, now they're betting $50. I mean, all these kids are gambling in college. They're now coming to the track, the young kids, and you're getting younger and younger fans because of all the ways that you could bet now. And if you're going to be able to put a product on the track and let these guys come with a $50 bill and make wagers at the track, make it so that they feel like, hey, they've got a fair situation going on.
No, I certainly agree with
that. And that's obviously important if they want to get, you know, new and young players.
Yeah, and you know, and keep them. I mean, that's
and keep them.
Well, part of reaching out to you, and I've got a couple other players, you know, that have been around playing the game for decades, and that are getting frustrated. You know, I want to let them. You know, I want to hear the perspective, so I appreciate it. Mark, I got to get Seth Merrow in, but it's terrific to meet this way. I know your name, obviously, and look forward to seeing you, you know, down the road.
Steve, you do a great job for horse racing, and really great listening to you all the time.
I appreciate it. Mark Lieb, everybody, and want to have these kinds of, you know, conversations, and people that are putting money into the game one way or another, as players, as owners. Let's slip Seth in. We got about 5 minutes to get some plays. I'll save Seth's conversation when it comes to the Derby Quad, his four horses that Seth's going to look at. We'll save that for maybe tomorrow. But right now, there's a chance for Seth to score out after missing that 20-1 shot. I can't not let Seth offer up some opinions. Good morning.
The Tampa plays last week were okay. Gave out that exact botch in the last night. Yeah. I think it was a $14 winner, I think. But the Tampa, if you pick up the one, you were trying to talk me out of Tampa last week, and I went 7-for-9 with winners on top of the couple of double digits. Yeah. It's crazy. The Capital LTV one sheet was. I had that wear an asbestos glove to read it yesterday with the Tampa, or last week with the Tampa play. But since we only have a few minutes left, I had some Tampa plays, and people can go over and pick up the one sheet at CapitalOTV.com. But I'm going to toss out a 4x4x4 pick three. For 50 cents, it'll cost you $32. But at Keeneland, I think the favorite in the first leg, and I'm going to start in the third, I'm not thrilled with the favorite. If the favorite can win, if the horse wins, it's not going to shock me. But at Keeneland, I have been saying now on TV since opening day, I think the Turfway horses get overlooked at Keeneland, and they've been running well again this season, and I think this season at Turfway has been saltier than previous years, so it's maybe even a little more potent.
Sure.
And I have some Turfway horses in the mix. So in the first leg, the third race, maiden 20s, I'm going to go 3, 11, 12, and 5. And again, I'm going to leave out number nine, Get By. That might be a mistake, but as I say, I'm just going to play around in here. Icy Stare comes in from Turfway. Tyler Gaffleone on board. Tried, you know, this claiming company last time, showed some speed before fading, but had some blinkers today. Gormley-esque, and I'm Here for the Party, also coming in from Turfway. Gormley-esque making a drop from Maiden Special Weight that may get this one into the mix this afternoon. And I think I'm Here for the Party in the third career start could be a little bit interesting. Also from Turfway, same scenario. 30-1 on Carmel Sunrise, coming in from Turfway. The price, given the talent level of this horse, I think is a little high. I think the five can be a player in here. So, again, some prices to maybe start things off on a little bit of a play. 3-11, 12, and 5 in the second leg. We're on the turf for Maiden Specials. I'll go 6, 4, 8, and 7 in the fourth. I'll put Fancy Cabernet on top. Coming in from Turfway for Joe Sharp. Shows some speed, has been fading, now moves over to the turf, and I think could be a little bit interesting. Fourth career start, you know, you talk about it, seeing that line of ones in the prior race, and then they can move forward, maybe hold on to that front-running position in the follow-up. I'll hope that's the case here. Ian Wilkes, who's having a good meet, trains Masterful Meg, nice steady string of workouts. I think this could be an interesting horse in the career debut, and I said Ian's having a good meet. The other day, Friday, I think it was, one with a horse named Bourbon Resolve, who has some connections up here in Saratoga. And I played basketball with one of the folks on the team. So we were shooting the breeze on Friday, and I wished him good luck. And then when I played Monday morning at the Y, I gave him a high five. That was a nice win and a $100,000 Maiden Special for Bourbon Resolve. But again, Ian's having a good meet, so we'll go with number four, Masterful Meg. And then Make the Boys Wink. Comes up from Gulfstream from Brendan Walsh off a series of improving numbers, and Chad has up and down, hasn't been seen since Saratoga. So one of those that I think has the potential to come back and be interesting as a, you know, new three-year-old, at least new on the track as a three-year-old. So there are some, a couple of morning line prices in there that could juice things up a little bit. And then in the fifth and final leg of the pick three, I'll go 6, 7, 1, and 2. 10-1 on Group 18. Yet another one that I like coming in from Turfway. You know, moves up to a little stiffer company. But the last couple of races, I thought, were okay. Went through the N2L condition and a 30 tag, and then bumped up to N3L and ran a decent little third. Now's in a 50B condition, but looks to fit with this bunch. And so the 10-1 looks generous. Long Shadow, I think class-wise, is going to stack up nicely coming up from Tampa most recently. That was off a little bit of a layoff, so I would think this horse may be a little bit fitter. And subsequent to that last Tampa start, put in a little bullet workout down at Palmetto's. And then Invisible War, 2-1, that's the Mark Cassie kind of logical runner with Irod Ortiz. So we'll throw that one in Raymond at a little bit of a price. But again, comes up from Oaklawn and I think is going to class up nicely with this bunch. So in the fifth, I'll use 6, 7, 1, and 2. So again, it's a little bit of a deeper ticket than I would normally put together. But I think there's a couple of prices in there, and we're taking a little stand against the favorite in the opening leg.
Yeah, exactly, by leaving out the 9. So 3, 5, 11, 12, 4, 7, 4, 6, 7, 8. With 1, 2, 6, 7 is Seth's $32 pick three. Good luck. We'll talk and do your Derby quad horses tomorrow.
Sounds good. Good luck to everybody, and have a good day.
Seth Merrow, everybody. Mark Lieb joined us as well. Jennifer Kelly and the Foxes of Bel Air. Sid, of course. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hillendale. And Hong Kong Action. Dick got beat in that third leg, unfortunately. There you go. Enjoy the day. Good luck. Keeneland, Indy, and much, much more. Talk to you tomorrow.
XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research.